Here's a look at our top stories this hour. At least 9 Israeli settlers are wounded in shooting attacks in several locations near Al-Quds Old City. The suspect in the stabbing of the British author of a blasphemous anti-Islam book is charged with attempted murder. Also ahead, Ukraine says fierce fighting continues in Pisky hours after Russia said its forces took full control of the town on the outskirts of Donetsk region. Hello and welcome. Your world news come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Top story this hour, a gunman conducts several shooting attacks in the city of Al-Quds, wounding at least 9 Israeli settlers, several of them seriously. Israeli media say shots were fired toward an Israeli bus, a vehicle, and pedestrian settlers. Israeli police say the suspected assailant, or assailants, I should correct, has fled the scene and a manhunt is underway. Israeli forces have reportedly stormed the Silwan neighborhood on the outskirts of Al-Quds Old City as part of their manhunt to find him. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has praised the attack as heroic, calling it a natural response to Israel's daily crimes against Palestinians and Muslim holy sites. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the expansion of Israeli settlements on the occupied territories and the regime's demolition drive amount to an open war against Palestinian people. Hamas issued the warning in a statement against the backdrop of plans by Israel to build a new settlement in the West Bank and demolish a Palestinian school there. Separately, the movement's spokesman said Israel violates international law by committing crimes against Palestinians. Hazem Qasem blamed the international community for standing idly by in the face of the regime's atrocities. He added that the Israeli crimes will make Palestinians more determined to defend their lands and liberate Palestine from the regime's occupation. Iran's deputy foreign minister has condemned Israel for killing Palestinian children. Ali Bagherikani was speaking in a meeting with Qatar's deputy foreign minister for regional affairs, Mohammed bin Abdulaziz Al Khulaifi, in Tehran. He said child killing has become a norm for Israel. Bagherikani added that such a practice shows the strategic fear of the Israeli regime toward the future. He urged Muslim nations to ramp up support for Palestinian people. On Thursday, the UN rights chief raised the alarm about the number of Palestinian children killed and wounded by Israel this year. Michelle Bachelet called the killing of Palestinian kids unconscionable. Pro-Palestine activists took to the streets of Austria's capital, Vienna, amid international fury over Israel's murderous bombing of Gaza, which saw scores of innocent civilians killed. Our correspondent Robert Carter has traveled to Vienna and witnessed local action as demands for justice continue to grow.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine activists marched through central Vienna on Friday to vent their anger following Israel's recent bombardment of Gaza. They joined thousands of other protesters worldwide who were shocked into action after the three-day Israeli offensive left over 350 Palestinians wounded, 46 dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials.
Following the recent violence against Gaza, shocking images of children suffering and dying went absolutely viral on social media. Yet despite these disturbing images doing the rounds, they haven't been routinely featured in Western mainstream media circles. In fact, it's incredibly rare for any images of Palestinian suffering to be published at all.
They are suffering every day, every single day. People got arrested, children got arrested, people got murdered. Gaza, what we saw last week in three, 4 days, got bombed. They have no electricity, they have no way to go anywhere. They are blocked from the Israeli occupation.
I need to tell my people that we are standing up for them. We are resisting from abroad. So you have to stay strong. And I'm an artist, so it is a duty for me to raise the voice for the ones who are not heard.
We need to raise our voice, and Austria cooperates with Israel. And that's what we are doing here also is that we want to make people aware of this, that Austria is cooperating with Israel.
Despite regular condemnation of Israeli aggression by human rights groups, Palestinians continue to suffer while the Western world looks on, leaving few options left for Palestinians driven to fight for their very survival. Robert Carter, Vienna.
A man accused of stabbing the notorious author of a blasphemous anti-Islam book has pledged not guilty to charges of attempted murder and assault. A lawyer for the 24-year-old suspect entered the plea on his behalf during a formal hearing at a court in New York. U.S. prosecutors leveled the charges against him, saying he was remanded without bail for attacking Salman Rushdie. Rushdie was stabbed on stage during an event in New York on Friday. He is in the hospital in serious condition. Rushdie published his blasphemous novel, The Satanic Verses, in the late 80s. The novel triggered an outcry across the Muslim world. Muslims still remain resentful of the sacrilegious comments made in his book. Political commentator Sayyid Mohsen Abbas says Salman Rushdie was a tool in the hands of the West to confront Islam. Have a listen.
On an individual level, he'd kind of outlived his usefulness. I guess Rushdie takes the inauspicious honor or denigration of being, the first potential tool of Western neoliberal deep state in that process of its war on Islam, the real Islam which talks about justice and talks about governments which should be just and talks about a system which is, you know, anti-usurious perhaps, anti-corruption, anti-exploitation of the masses.
Fighting rages in Ukraine's Donbass region. Russian forces say they have taken full control of Pisky, a village in the outskirts of Donetsk.
Armed forces of the Russian Federation continue a special military operation in Ukraine. As a result of Russian and pro-Russian forces' advance, Pisky in Donetsk People's Republic has been fully liberated. On an airfield near Domanivka in Mykolaiv region, two Mi-24 helicopters of Ukrainian air forces were destroyed. Russian air defense systems destroyed four Ukrainian drones in the last 24 hours in Kharkiv region.
That is why the Ukraine's military command now says fierce fighting continues in Pisky. It says the Russian forces are trying to break through the defense of Ukrainian troops in the area. Meantime, the Russian Defense Ministry says his forces have destroyed a U.S.-supplied HIMARS rocket system and an ammunition depot close to the city of Kramatorsk. Capturing Donbass has been the main goal of Moscow since February when the conflict began in Ukraine. The eastern region is made up of Luhansk and Donetsk provinces, where the conflict has been focused. Luhansk is now almost completely under Russian control, but Ukrainian forces are still holding out in Donetsk. Thousands of South Korean progressives and unionists have gathered in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises scheduled to begin on August 22nd. Labor leaders called for the end of such drills, warning the Korean Peninsula is inching toward nuclear war. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land, and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
반대한다는 겁니다.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the US forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a US aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In an unprecedented incident, the FBI searched former U.S. President Donald Trump's residence in Florida earlier this week. Now a search warrant, unsealed by a judge, says top secret files were seized from Trump's estate. Trump is accused of violating rules on official records, something he denies. The former president and his Republican allies have accused the FBI of being corrupt and politicized.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in the position where he legally can't run for office.
The FBI search of Trump's estate has drawn fierce rhetoric from the former president and his allies. They have pledged to hold the Biden administration to account. That comes as reports say FBI agents were looking for classified documents related to nuclear weapons. Mid-August marks 1 year since the Taliban takeover Afghanistan. The political change opened a new chapter in the war-torn country, affecting the lives of millions. Rahmatullah Baghwan has a report for us from Kabul.
In mid-August last year, the Taliban took control of Afghanistan, and the Western-backed government collapsed. On its anniversary, the Afghan people have not forgotten what they went through during this period. economic collapse triggered by the U.S. seizure of nearly $9 billion in Afghan assets and cuts in global aid has been one of their main struggles. Afghans lived through a harsh winter with little food. Based on a poll by Gallup Institute, nearly all Afghans rated their lives as poorly enough to be considered suffering. Meanwhile, some neighboring countries and international bodies rushed aid to the country.
We witnessed that after the Taliban takeover, people sold their children and body organs to put food on the table. I personally lost my job and have been unemployed for months. Millions of others were unable to make ends meet due to food and cash scarcity. I urge the U.S. and the international community to release frozen Afghan funds and let the flow of aid. Afghans can no longer bear the ongoing miseries.
The security situation in the meantime has been far better than in the past two decades. That's to say, people experience less violence and conflict this year. However, the occasional attacks by the Daesh terrorist group continue to haunt the community.
Previously, our people were living with the U.S. bombardments on their territories. Under the pretext of the war against terror, the U.S. pushed terror in Afghanistan for 20 years and violated all rights of Afghans. Since the Taliban have come to power, our country has been more secure and peaceful. I hope the Taliban succeed in cracking down on Daesh terrorist group and tightening security for all.
The Taliban, on the other hand, failed to gain international recognition. Afghans and the global community have criticized the Taliban for not forming an all-inclusive government.
This week marks the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover. To date, the Taliban have been unable to form a government representing all walks of Afghan society and protect their rights. In Afghanistan's history, no government has been successful without securing national legitimacy and being inclusive. The Taliban should learn from the past, seek fair engagement with Afghans, and be flexible against the global community.
All things considered, international bodies and rights groups continue to engage with the de facto Taliban to advocate for the rights of Afghans and address their needs. They also have been calling on the Taliban to open girls' schools as soon as possible. 1 year into the Taliban government, Afghans are calling on the international community to help the country's economy and force the U.S. to release its frozen assets. At the same time, they say the new government should engage more in diplomacy with other countries to improve the situation in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Limelight. Some studies suggest that the risk of cardiovascular problems such as a heart attack or stroke remains high even many months after a SARS-CoV-2 infection clears up. Researchers are starting to pin down the frequency of these issues and what is causing the damage. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Saima Meisadir, writer. This article is published under the heading Heart Disease After COVID, What the Data Say. Here's the story. In December 2020, a week before cardiologist Stuart Cotts was scheduled to receive his first COVID-19 vaccine, he came down with a fever. He spent the next 2 weeks racked with a cough, body aches, and chills. After months of helping others to weather the pandemic, Cotts, who works at New York University, was having his own first-hand experience of COVID-19. On Christmas Day, Cotts' acute illness finally subsided, but many symptoms lingered, including some related to the organ he's built his career around, the heart. Walking up two flights of stairs would leave him breathless, with his heart racing at 120 beats per minute. Over the next several months, he began to feel better and is now back to his normal routine of walking and cycling. But reports about COVID-19's effects on cardiovascular system have made him concerned about his long-term health. I say to myself, well, is it really over, Cotts says. In one study this year, researchers used records from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs to estimate how often COVID-19 leads to cardiovascular problems. They found that people who had the disease faced substantially increased risk for 20 cardiovascular conditions, including potentially catastrophic problems such as heart attacks and strokes, in the year after infection with the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2. Researchers say these complications can happen even in people who seem to have completely recovered from a mild infection. Some smaller studies have mirrored these findings, but others find lower rates of complications. With millions or perhaps even billions of people having been infected with SARS-CoV-2, clinicians are wondering whether a pandemic will be followed by a cardiovascular aftershock. Meanwhile, researchers are trying to understand who is most at risk of these heart-related problems, how long the risk persists, and what causes these symptoms. It's a gaping hole in an important area of public health, says Cotts. We don't understand if this changes the lifelong trajectory for risk of a heart attack or a stroke or other cardiac events. We just don't know that, he said. Here, nature looks at the questions that scientists are asking and the answers they have uncovered so far. Doctors have reported cardiovascular problems related to COVID-19 throughout the pandemic, but concerns over this issue surged after the results of VA study came out earlier this year. The analysis by Ziad Al-Ali, an epidemiologist at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and his colleagues, is one of the most effective efforts to characterize what happens to the heart and the circulatory system after the acute phase of COVID-19. The researchers compared more than 150,000 veterans who had recovered from acute COVID-19 with their uninfected peers as well as with a pre-pandemic control group. People who had been admitted to intensive care with acute infections had a drastically higher risk of cardiovascular problems during the next year. For some conditions, such as swelling of the heart and blood clots in the lungs, the risk shot up at least 20-fold compared with that in infected peers. But even people who had not been hospitalized had increased risk of many conditions, ranging from an 8% increase in the rate of heart attacks to a 247% increase in the rate of heart inflammation. For Al-Ali, this study added to the growing body of evidence that about of COVID-19 can permanently alter some people's health. These kinds of change fall under the category of post-acute sequel of COVID-19, which covers problems that emerge after an initial infection. This disorder includes and overlaps with the persistent condition known as long COVID, a term that has many definitions. Studies indicate that the coronavirus is associated with a wide range of lasting problems such as diabetes, persistent lung damage, and even brain damage. As with these conditions, Al-Ali says that the cardiovascular issues that occur after SARS-CoV-2 infection can decrease a person's quality of life over the long term. Treatments do exist for these problems, but they are not curable conditions, he adds. Despite its large size, the VA study does come with caveats, say researchers. The study is observational, meaning that it reuses data that were collected for other purposes, a method that can introduce biases. For example, the study considers only veterans, meaning that the data are skewed towards white men. We don't really have any study like it that goes into more diverse and younger populations, says Eric Topol, a genomicist at Scripps Research in La Jolla, California. He thinks that more research is needed before scientists can truly quantify the frequency at which cardiovascular problems strike. Danielle Tensuri, a medical statistician at the University of California, Davis, points out another potential source of bias. One of the control groups in the VA study had to get through more than a year without catching SARS-CoV-2 to be included in the study. There could be physiological differences that make the control group less likely to contract the disease, which could also affect their susceptibility to cardiovascular problems. Still, Tensuri thinks the study was well designed and that any bias is likely to be minimal. I wouldn't say that these members are exactly right, but they are definitely in the ballpark, he says. He hopes future prospective studies will fine-tune Al-Ali's estimates. Vaccinations, reinfections, and the Omicron variant of SARS-CoV-2 all pose new questions about the virus's cardiovascular effects. A paper published in May by Al-Ali and his colleagues suggests that vaccination reduces but does not eliminate the risk of developing these long-term problems. Hanson, a scientist, is also eager to model whether reinfections compound the risk and whether the relatively mild but widespread Omicron variant will affect the cardiovascular system as drastically as other variants. He says, "We are kind of chomping at a bit for follow-up data among Omicron cases."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us ponder on what the chief of martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, has taught us when he stood steadfast against threats to his life by the forces of injustice and oppression, while disclosing to the Muslims the characteristics of the Umayyad rule, and analysing the political and administrative situation from the Islamic point of view. O people, the Prophet of Allah had said, whoever witnesses an unjust ruler making permissible the things prohibited by Allah, breaking the covenant with Allah, violating the practices of the Prophet, treating people sinfully and cruelly, and despite seeing all such misdeeds, did not oppose him through words or actions, Allah surely will punish him as he wills.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, firm determination of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone. You are listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio, and I'm your host, Hussein Henzano. Now, in today's lesson, we are talking about the firm determination of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. When you're talking about the firm determination of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam, it makes us reflect on the characteristics and the characteristics of the personality of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam. Prophet Muhammad, at his time of prophethood, he had a firm determination against the enemies of Islam. He stood against them. He said anything that was to be said in order for him to make sure that Islam stands up and Islam stands strong. At the time, people really stood against him. People beat the Prophet at the time. People was talking bad words against the Prophet. People were saying bad things about the Prophet. People were talking, people did everything they could do to make sure that the Prophet is not successful in spreading his word of Islam. But at the same time, the Prophet stood against them firmly. He said, I'm not going to stand back against my religion. I'm not going to stand back and stop talking about Islam and stop spreading the religion of God, subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the Prophet continued. He stood firmly and he said he will continue no matter what. And he stood in every aspect of his life, in his personal life, in the life whereby he went for the battles. So Imam, if the Prophet was this fine in his characteristics. And then Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, as we see in his lifestyle, we realize that definitely he had a firm determination against the tyrant rulers of the time, against the Umayyad rulers of the time, against the Umayyad fighters of the time. He stood against them. He said, I'm never going to pay allegiance to any one of you. I'm going to stand and continue the path of my grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Wa alayk.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano, and we are talking about the firm determination of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam moved towards the field of honor and respect with his family members of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and his companions so that he may hoist the flag of Islam and obtain a great success and victory for the nation of Islam till he finally reached martyrdom. Peace of God be on him, as he was the strongest person with regard to determination and foremost with regard to will and intention. Imam Hussein alayhi salam did not mind bearing all those circumstances that make the intellect and mind bewildered. We can reminisce on the happening of Karbala when Al-Imam Hussein and his holy progeny were there. They stood against a very big number of fighters. The fighters were ready to kill them, but Imam Hussein and his family stood firmly against them. No one stayed back. And in fact, Al-Imam Hussein was reported at the time, he told some of his Sahabas, or all of his Sahabas, that whoever feels that he's not ready to stand against these bad rulers, bad fighters of the Umayyad fighters, he can go, he can leave, and he's free to go. But still, the Sahabas told Imam Hussein, "Oh, Imam Hussein, we are not going to leave you alone. We're going to stand here and fight against these people as much as their number is bigger than us." This was the firm determination that could be realized, that could be read from the life of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Till next episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
If you're a private collector of wild animals, there is good news for you. A Pakistani zoo is auctioning off a dozen lions due to a lack of money to feed them and a space to house them. Lahore Safari Zoo currently has so many big cats that they have to take turns accessing paddocks. Officials say auctioning them will free up space and also reduce expenses. Zoo is currently housing 29 lions. The lions auctioned this week will be between 2 to 5 years of age. Each big cat is estimated to fetch around 150,000 Pakistan rupees. That's not too much, as some zookeepers claim. Even conservationists have expressed anger over auctioning lions to private collectors instead of transferring them to other zoos. Happy news for zoo goers in Nicaragua. Two adorable baby tapirs are born at a country's national zoo south of Managua, adding attractions to the visitors. Two endangered tapirs a male and a female were born hours apart at the weekend. In a video shared by the zoo, one of the newborns is seen suckling and walking near her mother. The director of the zoo says the babies are yet to be named but are in perfect health. Tapirs inhabit jungle and forest regions of South and Central America, with one species inhabiting Southeast Asia. They look something like pigs with trunks, but they are actually related to horses and rhinos. Nicaragua launched a project that seeks to conserve this animal in danger of extinction due to hunting and the destruction of natural habitat. Now we'll take you to mine-riddled French island, Chesomes, which is emerging from the ruins and gradually turning into workers' paradise. Chesomes, close to the port city of Saint-Malo, has an amazing landscape but remains uninhabited as it saw a devastating bombardment by the Allies during the World War II. The Nazi-occupied island was victim of the most bombings per square meter. Known as Martyred and Forbidden Island, it was opened only in 2018 after extensive demining efforts allowed the opening of a marked path. Now, every year, thousands of day trippers make the short boat journey, marveling at the spectacular maritime views and flourishing wildlife there. The safe area still makes up just 3% of the island, but it lets visitors wander between rusty cannons and bunkers. Some workers say they hope the trail will be lengthened to allow a complete tour of the island.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism. The Jamtal Glacier in Austria has been losing around 1 meter of its surface annually. Scientists say the ice is a precious archive that is simply melting away and are surveying the area. Austrian mountain researchers say the glaciers contain an invaluable trove of ancient frozen leaves and twigs and other scientific treasures that can be lost forever. They say the time capsules, including the remote Jamtal Valley, are falling victim to climate change. In the 1990s, tourists found that 5,300-year-old mummy of Iceman near the same area. According to the international data, global warming has raised temperatures in Europe's highest mountains by nearly 2 degrees Celsius in the past 120 years. French rescuers are racing against time to save a beluga whale stranded in Seine River near Paris. The beluga was first spotted stuck between two locks in the river from Paris to the English Channel on Tuesday. Specialists say the animal is undernourished and is refusing food. Warm water is also worsening the health of this creature, which is normally seen near Norway, some 3,000 kilometers to the north. Rescuers say they have only up to 48 hours to save the whale. They are now looking at the possibility of taking the beluga out of the water, treating it, and eventually transferring it out to the sea.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day since the menu largely includes local flavors.
Visitors and staff at a French zoo have celebrated the first birthday of twin pandas. The young bears were given a tasty treat of frozen cakes and other treats. As part of the event, five lucky visitors were also given the chance to participate in the celebrations behind the scenes with golden tickets. Other festivities included face painting and panda-themed activities. The baby pandas were born last August and now weigh 23 and 28 kilograms. They live with their mother at Zoo Parc de Bouval, where they have been on display since their arrival in 2021.
Many people develop deeper relationships with four-legged animals, treating them like their own kids. A Kenyan conservationist is one of them. 33-year-old Salome Lemasia has been a community ranger in Sierra Conservancy, northern Kenya, since 2015. The mother of four is stationed at a rhino sanctuary and is in charge of protecting a male rhino named Loijipo. At just a few days old, Loijipo was abandoned by his mother, possibly due to her being spooked by something. After being cared for, he was returned to the sanctuary under surveillance in an attempt to rewild him. 3 years on, from his release into Sierra Wilderness, he is taking his time to carve out his territory, of course, with the help of Salome. The chess fever in the southern Indian city of Chennai is on a peak as the 44th International Chess Olympiad kicks off there. Students created a mammoth chessboard on the playground and dressed up as 32 chess pieces to promote the game. For 2 weeks, Chennai is hosting nearly 2,000 players from 188 countries. For the first time in nearly 100 years of history of the Chess Olympiad, India is playing host. The event will run until August the 10th. Ahead of the game, 150 underprivileged children from various government schools were given the opportunity to fly. These were the students who won in a district-level chess tournament. Excited spectators gather at the Solberg Airport in the U.S. for the 39th New Jersey Lottery Festival of Ballooning.
We have about 45 balloons here today, including these spectacular special shapes. Our signature New Jersey Lottery Sunny Days balloon. You can see the tiger. Unicorn is hiding behind there. Tasmanian Devil, unique photo panda. We are having a spaceship. There's Billy the Kid. Spectacular presentation. You won't believe your skies this weekend.
Dozens of hot air balloons were test-inflated in preparation for the real deal. The festival is considered the largest summertime event in New Jersey. Reddington City officials have predicted about 170,000 people will join the festival over the weekend. Weather forecasts say the sky are gentle enough for over 100 balloons to take flight in the morning and evening in mass ascents. And no one is more excited than the festival producer, who has been planning the event for months.
Including these spectacular special shapes, the balloons bring out the kid in everyone. You know, I've done this for a long time. This is the 39th annual one. But still, when I hear that propane whirring and these balloons going up, it makes the hair on my arm stand up.
The producer says these balloons will be handled by professional pilots and other balloons will be available for rides. The festival will last for 3 days, ending with food vendors, games, amusement rides, and other entertainment. There will also be a massive fireworks display, as well as a nighttime feature of glowing balloons. The annual festival is the largest seasonal hot air balloon festival in North America. It draws in thousands of visitors every year.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has waded into the Tory leadership row over energy costs by declaring he's absolutely certain his successor will offer further help to households, as annual bills were forecast to top £4,200 by January. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Rowena Mason and Alex Lawson. The piece is titled, Johnson Absolutely Certain Next Prime Minister Will Offer More Help on Paying Bills. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has waded into the Tory leadership row over energy costs by declaring he's absolutely certain his successor will offer further help to households, as annual bills were forecast to top £4,200 by January. Boris Johnson made an unexpected intervention on energy bills at a Number 10 reception, as Liz Truss, the front-runner to be the next Prime Minister, was accused by Rishi Sunak's campaign of being divorced from reality over her refusal to commit to more handouts. Boris Johnson has repeatedly refused to act on rocketing gas and electricity bills before leaving office on 5th of September, but said he was sure the next Prime Minister will be wanting to make some more announcements in September or October about what we're going to do further to help people in the next period in December and January. He added, I just want you to know that I'm absolutely confident that we will have the fiscal firepower and the headroom to continue to look after people as we've done throughout. The deepening row over how to help households came on the day annual energy bills were forecast to exceed £4,200 from January, triggering a warning that Britons face serious hardship on a massive scale without government intervention. At the same time, government sources have admitted officials have modelled the possibility of a four-day power shortage in the first quarter of next year, potentially requiring rolling blackouts for industry and households. Boris Johnson's comments add further pressure on Liz Truss to acknowledge that, as Prime Minister, she would need to give households more help beyond tax cuts. As Liz Truss doubled down on her plan for reversing the national insurance rise and removing £150 of green levies, a Sunak campaign spokesperson said her proposals will not touch the sides for a majority of British families this winter, and pensioners will get no help whatsoever. The consultancy Cornwall Insight said on Tuesday, 9th of August, that it expected the energy price cap to reach £4,266 a year for the first 3 months of next year, more than triple the level it was at a year previously and more than double the current level. Any shortages of energy over the winter caused by less gas and less electricity from Norway and the rest of Europe could push prices up even further. But Liz Truss said at the weekend that she does not want to give handouts to people struggling with bills, preferring to prioritise tax cuts. She repeatedly refused to promise any further help on energy bills on Tuesday, 9th of August, only confirming plans to reverse the recent increase in national insurance and to temporarily suspend green levies on energy bills. Liz Truss doubled down on her economic stance on Tuesday night by brandishing cash handouts to help with the cost of living as Gordon Brown economics. Speaking at Conservative hustings in Darlington, which was dominated by questions on bills, the Foreign Secretary underlined that she believed the best route to help with the cost of living crisis was cutting taxes, starting with national insurance. Liz Truss said, "I didn't agree with raising national insurance. We promised not to do it in our manifesto, and we need to help those people who are struggling with the cost of living. We need to be on the side of the self-employed. We need to be on the side of people who work and do the right thing, and we need to enable people to keep more of their own money. Those are conservative principles," she said. Liz Truss added, "What I don't support is taking money off people in tax and then giving it back to them in handouts. That, to me, is Gordon Brown economics." Rishi Sunak, in turn, warned that the British people will not forgive us if vulnerable households did not get extra direct help this winter. The former Chancellor Rishi Sunak said Liz Truss's plans would not help swathes of the population and said that whoever was Prime Minister should not rule out direct support. Truss has said she will emphasise tax cuts rather than committing to giving extra direct help with energy bills. "If you're a pensioner, if you're on the National Living Wage, tax cuts are worth zero," the former Chancellor said. "That's not a policy to help people get through the winter, and I think it's wrong to rule out help directly because we as a Conservative government have an obligation to help those who are most vulnerable. If we don't do that, not only will people suffer, but we will get absolutely hammered when it comes to the next election. The British people will not forgive us for not doing that." Critics of her policy warned that tax cuts disproportionately help the better off and offer no assistance to pensioners or those not in work, while the green levies contribute only about £150 annually to the average bill. "What's vitally important at this moment is we get economic growth going," Liz Truss told reporters on a visit to Huddersfield in West Yorkshire. "At the moment, we've got the highest taxes in 70 years. That's why I believe in lower taxes to get economic growth going, to encourage businesses to invest, and that way there will be more money in people's pockets." Asked if she was ruling out any other help for energy bills, Liz Truss replied, "What I am promising is that from day one, people will have lower taxes. They will also have lower energy bills because I'm going to put a temporary moratorium on the green energy levy.